Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. I've been away, but I've also been paying attention. U.S. President Donald Trump continues to roil the world, as a result of which South African automobile exports to the U.S. overnight last week became suddenly 25% more expensive for customers in the U.S. Needless to say, while Americans may have to pay a higher price for new cars, countries that manufacture like South Africa, small player though we are, will be paying a higher cost as well. It's hard to work out how much, but if the new Trump tariffs on cars are to stand, plus a further widespread 25% tariff increase on all imports of anything from wine to steel and oranges to petticoats later this week, what's to be done? For countries like South Africa, which have not paid much attention to our relations with the US, the cost could be dire. Even if you're a close US ally, a neighbor even, you're going to get smacked. We're way down the pecking order of global concern about US trade policy. The next months and years will ask cruel questions about our economic policies here and trade. And without a functioning ambassador, really, in the US for the past 3 years, we're going to battle to respond diplomatically or economically. At times like these, I'm always glad to have Donald Mackay to call on. He's CEO of XA Global Trade Advisory, but more than that, he really knows what he's talking about. He's an expert on our trade and the terms of our trade, and he's got deep insights into the kind of economy we're going to need to be to survive Trump, and probably the kind of economy we should have been before Trump. But instead of working hard, the ANC's neglected economic policy and substituted for it with redress and redistribution of what we already have. There's no growth and no strength anymore. President Cyril Ramaphosa would have us believe we're on course for reform, but in many ways he means little more than restoring the status quo ante to the days when the things that we used to have worked. So Donald, thanks for joining me. Your broad impressions of the peril we face now and how and where we find the resources to respond with 25% tariffs to our most profitable and our biggest trading partner, our most valuable trading partner. Let's say we run a surplus with the US. China might be a bigger market, a bigger trade partner, but we run a big deficit with them. What do we do about Trump?
Well, that's a question the whole world is wrestling with at the moment. I'd say it's probably worth just for a moment trying to understand what we're dealing with in Trump. So uncertainty and unpredictability are now simply the norm. We're never entirely sure what is going to happen from one day to the next. Trump himself doesn't appear to have a coherent strategy. He's got a very peculiar obsession with trade deficits or trade surpluses, which he seems to see as quite a significant economic ill. So in that environment, I think the first thing is that the US becomes a considerably less predictable trading partner. And that comes with fairly significant risks to South Africa as a country, but also producers who are dependent on the US market. So Trump, in a very kind of South African move, wants to localize everything into the US. I don't think that's possible, to be clear. The US has somewhere around a 4% unemployment rate. If you were to move all of these factories into the US, assuming that switch could be turned on as quickly as the tariffs are, you just wouldn't have people to work in the factories. And the people that are there are all being deported, whether they be Venezuelans or Mexicans or anyone else. So there are practical problems in the relocation, which means effectively those tariffs would just become a tax on American consumers. Now, I think from a South African perspective, if we're dealing with a less reliable trading partner, South Africa's got to strategically look at the basket of goods we send to the US and almost grade them. We've got products which are probably safe from any action in the short term from Trump. Many of our mined goods, platinum and so on, are not available in the US. So, those are probably safe. We've seen that autos are a problem. I have no idea what the big exporters like Mercedes-Benz are going to do. Now, I don't believe you can simply start producing them in one of the Mercedes-Benz plants in the US. So there will be consequences, but I think we've got to take a longer term strategic view and say the US is an unreliable partner. How does the world look, you know, understanding that? Number two, we probably don't want to go around deliberately antagonizing a very important trading partner. So, you know, maybe our president wants to stop authoring articles in foreign policy, which are upsetting to the Americans. Maybe we should not change the name of Santon Drive to Leila Khaled and so on. All of these appear to be almost no cost actions we can take, which at least improve the environment we're in. You know, I don't know how we deal with Trump in the long term. And by the way, I see he's not taken off the table the possibility of running for a third term today, Peter. So.
Well, he was saying that if he does run for a third term, it would actually be for a fourth term because the second term was taken away from him. So as far as he's concerned, he's in his third term because he lost the 2020 election. Nonetheless, you know, Trump in many ways is Trump, but you know, when I was talking earlier on in the intro, if you look at our top three trading partners, it's China, the US, and the EU, right? Unless I'm wrong, of all of those three, the US is the most valuable because we run this lovely surplus with it, and they buy more from us than we buy from them. It's irreplaceable in a way. I mean, you're not going to do that with the Chinese anytime soon. And Europe is going to have to protect itself as well, presumably, against Trump's tariffs, and will be raising its own trade barriers. So we're really in a bit of a bind. I mean, is it possible to trade your way out of a situation like this, or do you have to do something to protect your industries? And we'll come to it just now. You know, the way that the Department of Trade and Industries trade regulator, ITAC, is now going to do this review of steel tariffs. And the unspoken thing is with a view to raising them. How do we get out, generally, theoretically, how do you get out of a jam like this? Do you trade your way out, or do you enterprise your way out? What do you do? I mean, where do you begin?
Well, we must maybe... It's important to split our trade into different categories. So we're fairly good at digging rocks out of the ground. Our mining industry, of course, has found itself on the wrong end of some truly noxious mining policies. So we're probably not mining as much as we should, but it hasn't been replaced by manufactured goods. We're generally not a great manufacturer. I mean, we could be, but we're not. We have a largely 50% of the kids who start school don't finish school. You know, we find them sort of graduating to a traffic light nearby, which is terrible, but it's what our education system's doing. Our infrastructure is broken. You know, ports are the most expensive and some of the worst in the world. We have a rail system which makes no sense at all and largely doesn't function. And these are factors you need to get right. Even in good times. So in bad times, what is happening is we're effectively taxing our manufacturing sector with policies that make us uncompetitive. And I think in that world, that's a difficult situation to trade yourself out of, even locally. We're pretty good at farming. And if you look at our agricultural products, they do well. You know, we grow nachos and people buy them all over the world. We're pretty good at that. We're not that great when we process those products, but we're not bad. And then we're okay if we throw big enough subsidies at it. So nobody wants to make cars here if we stopped paying them $35 billion a year to make cars. I'm not saying we shouldn't make cars. I'm just saying that's, you know, our most sophisticated export of manufactured goods, but the taxpayer and the car consumer pays quite a heavy price for that. So South Africa is not a great manufacturer, and we're going to have to come to grips with that. I think we have to fix these underlying problems in our economy in order to be competitive. Your trade policy can't make you competitive. You know, it doesn't fix the port If you decide to tariff goods, is essentially what we're trying to do.
So just talk about AGOA. So this is the Africa Growth and God help me here, Africa Growth and
Opportunities
Act. Okay, so this is the great American sort of gift to Africa to encourage African democracies to, you know, copy the American way, and if you do, you can trade with us at very low tariffs. And there's this debate in South Africa all the time that if we are kicked out of AGOA, somehow the world falls apart. And I know that I've asked you on more than one occasion, because people keep telling me and writing notes to me and to the letters to the editor of Business Day when I mention it. But the tax benefit, as you've described it to me, and I'm going to believe you before anyone else, is really quite small for AGOA. You've put the actual tax or the tax-free bit that we get going into America at about 2 billion rand a year. Is that right, Donald?
Yeah, so it's actually gone up a little bit now because we're now exporting BMWs to the US as well. So the number's gone up. Yeah, it's around there. I mean, it's in that vicinity.
Okay.
And so that is the amount of tariff we save. It works out at around a total of 3.5% of the value of the goods that we export to
right.
the US.
Okay. So if we lost that because we were kicked out of AGOA, it would probably make no difference at all to whether our exports were competitive or whether we would stop producing something because we couldn't, you know, we suddenly weren't getting that benefit of that extra trade. In fact, I think you once told me or pointed out to me that if the Rand then took a hit because we lost the AGOA benefit, it would probably equalize the hit. In other words, because the Rand having taken a hit would be that much more competitive against the dollar, the 2 billion Rand that we gain through the tariffs would be kind of neutralized, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody will understand what I've just said, but I mean,
I agree completely. So, you know, where the thing becomes a problem is when you put the 25% on cars like Trump has done, which is a whole different order of magnitude. So in that world, the problem becomes a lot more severe. It's, I would guess there that we'd end up losing in the longer term production to regions like Mexico, which still retains some of those benefits. But the bigger problem is not so much an immediate short-term impact there, because you can't, you know, the factory doesn't disappear and appear in the US overnight. But simply people stop buying other brands, our brands. So the Mercedes-Benz C-Class made here may just be purchased, not purchased. Maybe they buy an Audi or some other vehicle. So I think that the hit we'll take there is material and potentially even existential to some of those automotive companies. But AGOA, no, I don't think. I don't think AGOA poses a real risk to any of our products.
One of the things that we do as South Africans is think that we're somehow special. And obviously Trump, having sort of turned the eye of Sauron onto us the way he did early on in his presidency, has done nothing but sharpen that sort of South African reaction to things that happen in the world. He is picking on us in a way, and it's because probably of the ICJ case against Israel. And he's, you know, then he's been persuaded that land expropriation with nil compensation is an assault on Afrikaner farmers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he's expelled the ambassador for being slightly injudicious with his diplomacy and his diplomatic language. However, he is appointing an ambassador here, I thought was quite a positive move in the sense that he's probably not going to attack us. You know, he's probably not going to destroy the country. He is doing a reasonable thing by appointing an ambassador quite early on. It took him ages in his first term to get an ambassador to Pretoria. Whatever we may think of the nomination, we have to welcome it. Simply for being, for existing. In other words, we're going to get an ambassador here. We'll have a fully functioning American embassy, and hopefully in time we'll have a fully functioning South African embassy in Washington, and we'll be able to somehow maybe just get a little bit of balance into the way the two countries relate to each other. But I really was going to just, rather than just make an observation, it's a positive thing, isn't it, that he's nominated this person, whatever his politics may be?
Absolutely. I mean, what it is, kind of the message I perhaps was choosing to take out of this is that by doing this, he's still trying to keep a door open in some way. I mean, what steps through the door? We don't know. I have no comment on the new ambassador. You know, one has to give him the benefit of the doubt. There's no reason to think he's going to behave poorly. What concerns me more is the way South Africa selects our next ambassador to the US. What we can't have is a situation where we've got some or other recycled, washed-out politician who has, you know, earned their spot for political reasons. I think we need a solid diplomat in that role who knows what they're doing. And, you know, we have a history of making horrible appointments as ambassadors. I think this is such an important role that we need to think very carefully. Not that I have a recommendation, but just that we cannot treat this as a place where we send, you know, some or other politician who has often embarrassed the party locally, and they get posted off to go and serve a couple of years in the US. I think we need somebody who is genuinely a strong diplomat. I've no reason to think we can't appoint such a person, but I think that role is important.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right. We need somebody strong, if not a career diplomat, certainly an experienced negotiator, or, you know, somebody who can, and obviously, you know, I don't think, you know, the color of the person matters, whether it's simply got to be somebody who knows what the bloody hell they're doing and is comfortable, you know, moving in relatively hostile waters and behaving in a calm and mature manner, which we failed to do up until now. So, Donald, if you look at the way we've created industrial policy in South Africa around centrally planned master plans, right? Are they now just blown out of the water? And I'm thinking of the auto industry we just talked about, steel, agriculture. Where are these plans now? I mean, you know, at best they were always pretty tentative stabs at, you know, at central planning, I suppose. Are they even worth looking at or referring to any longer?
I was never opposed to the idea of the master plans. I quite like the idea of getting the right people into the room to have a chat. But I think if the way the plan kind of unfolds is either the incumbents get to lobby the politician, and then what you get is just an extension of a highly concentrated economy, you know, sort of imposed on the consumers, which is to a large degree what happened, or even worse, just political decisions that are kind of put down onto industry by people who've never been in industry, then I think they yield terrible outcomes. I'd be reluctant to get rid of the idea, because I think having labor, business, and government in a room is generally better than not. But I think the objectives of what we're trying to achieve with our industrial policy needs to be clearer. So, you know, for many of the sectors, the reason they're not thriving has got nothing to do with the sector itself. Very often, it's some area of government which is not performing properly. So, you know, the ports are not working, or Eskom, or whatever it might be. I think if the master plans are about making the country more competitive and more productive, or those sectors, that's good. But very often, the reason the sectors are not competitive is not intrinsic to the sector itself, but usually because of the environment they operate in. So, you know, what comes to mind here is Astral Foods having to go to court for the right to supply themselves with water when their own municipality couldn't supply them with water. So, I mean, if that's the situation you're in, then it's not obvious to me how your chicken master plan is going to work, What I'd prefer to have had happen rather than just tariffs on chicken is, you know, what can we do to make sure the infrastructure in these areas works better? You know, these companies are spending a fortune on solar farms and all sorts of other stuff because Eskom can't supply them with electricity. You know, so the if our industrial policy is around improving competitiveness, which I have to say appears to be the objective of Minister Tao, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, then I think we get somewhere. But if really what we're trying to do is just replace imports, I think it's destined to failure.
And you think, well, we'll come to Park's Tower in a moment. But in this respect, then what about steel, right? So the state seems absolutely determined to save, and I'll say that in inverted commas, AMSA, particularly the Newcastle Long Products plant, which is now due for closure, which has been due for closure for more than 2 years now. It was announced just before the election and then taken off the table, put on the table again at the end of last year. Nobody paid any attention, put more on the table. People panicked, but they weren't ready to talk. Suddenly they're ready to talk at the very last minute, typical government. Why the panic? I mean, so I get an honorable mention in the Business Day column today of the ITAC commissioner. He writes in his personal capacity, but today's column is quite clearly in his capacity as ITAC commissioner. He says that do we undertake, because they now introduce this huge tariff review for steel, right? Every 600 products or whatever it might be. He says, do we undertake this review because we are obsessed with autarky, or as Peter Bruce suggests, fixated with nostalgia for a siege-focused apartheid-style industrial policy? Neither. What's the point of saving AMSA or the long products? Why bother? If there's cheap alternatives available on the high seas so that South African users can have access to cheap steel, why can't we give it to them?
Well, so I think that's probably not the correct way to frame the problem. So I think the problem we're sitting with is that the world is awash with too much steel and too few projects to consume that steel. And a lot of that is an outcome of the collapse of China's construction sector, which was an enormous absorber of steel. So China's economy is not doing well. Their consumption has dropped off of steel. The Chinese government supports their industries in ways that are very often not compliant with the WTO. And then the effect of all of that is that there's now too much steel floating around everywhere. So there's panic. And I think in this case that the panic is legitimate. But this is not a problem that arose now. This is a problem that's been arising for years and years. And mostly there have been meetings and no doubt many stern conversations, but very little actual action taken. So I think, you know, why is this in a panic at the moment? Well, I think because everything was happening on, you know, I think Mittal, what appears to have been largely been ignored for the last year, get to the beginning of this year and say, listen, we're absolutely going to start closing down. I think that's what drives the pressure. So to the question of whether we should have a Mittal, I'm sort of agnostic on that. But here's the cost of not having Mittal, which we do need to account for. So one of them is our ports are simply not going to cope with the volume that we need to bring in. So if Mittal were to disappear tomorrow, we couldn't immediately put through the volume through our ports. I mean, remember, Peter, to my earlier comment, our ports are largely broken. They don't function well. So they're not going to suddenly cope with this volume. The second is there are some sectors, automotive might be a very good example, where it takes a while to get a new supplier approved. So, you know, if it goes into a car, there's safety issues, et cetera, and the head office has to approve the supplier. There may also be some, I can't comment because I'm not a metallurgist, but there may be some applications where for whatever reason you don't want to import. Maybe that is the case. So There's, you know, if we shut down Mattel, we must accept that there's a portion of the downstream industry that goes with it. But having said that, we've created a set of the problems that Mattel is experiencing through other policies, which have put them in a dilemma. So there does not appear, at least at this point, much appetite to reduce the support given to the scrap metal minimals. So yeah, that is a problem.
Just explain to people listening how that affects Mattel.
Oh, sure.
And Mattel, let's just remind people that Mattel is the old ISCOR, which is an integrated steel producer. In other words, they make their own steel, and then they make their own steel products from that. And it's the only one in South Africa. In fact, it's the only one, I think, on the continent.
I think you're right.
And the scrap metal subsidies, not subsidies, but the way the policies have contributed to Mattel's weakening, and Donald will explain.
In fact, I'm just correct, both of us, there is now a primary steel mill in Zimbabwe as well, producing a small range of product out of iron ore.
Okay.
But be that as it may. So, well, what do we have here? So the mini mills get their scrap metal at a discount, and there's laws that have been written in to force generators of scrap to sell at a discount. If they don't, they can't get an export permit. So the value of the subsidy because of the forced discount is somewhere between 6.5 and 8.5 billion rand a year. And then you add another couple of hundred million on export duty. So if nobody wants to buy your product locally, you still pay an export duty. And then you've got IDC funding that sector to the tune at the moment of around 14 billion rand, with presumably friendly terms on that finance. And so the problem is, in a world awash with steel, what we've done is we've been giving money to companies to produce even more steel. And the range of product that is generated by the mini mill has an enormous overlap with the range of product coming out of Newcastle. And so if you're in Newcastle, you're struggling to compete against China. But there is now so much steel coming out of the mini mills that you have China on your doorstep, if you like. And you can't put a tariff in place against China, against the mini mills. So the mini mills are getting a subsidy. It's causing overproduction. And the overproduction means the product on these products the price on these products has collapsed. And so we see this because many of these mini mills are already in business rescue. So in fact, the value of the mini mills currently in business rescue is greater than the market capitalization of Mattel. And it's 2/3 of the IDC's book in business rescue are these mini mills. So we're in a weird position here where we're overproducing steel locally. The world is overproducing steel, and Mattel finds itself besieged on all sides. And so it's not clear to me, without them receiving a subsidy, how Newcastle can ever produce steel and sell it profitably with these dual pressures. And I think this is the nub of the problem. And government has to remove the cash out of that market. This is not the moment when you want to throw more money at the problem. And in other words, the whole market is overheated. We've created a bubble, if you like. And the bubble to burst, one way it could burst is Mattel shuts down Newcastle and takes some of that volume out of the market.
And so what we lose if it does that, right? So the car companies lose something. I'm not sure what long product that Mattel makes at Newcastle. They need, I know that they make, you know, they'll produce axles but they're certainly not using it. You know, they're not casting engines with Mattel steel. They're not covering, sort of making car bodies with Mattel steel. I'm not sure what the product is, but you would have thought, if you were a responsible car company and the CEO of whatever it might be, for VW or whatever, that the first time Mattel put its hand up and said we're closing, which is now the end of 2023, you would have made a few calls, and you would have, hang on a second, you know, let's look around and see where else that's available. And presumably, with so much steel floating around, steel companies would be falling over themselves to supply Volkswagen South Africa with whatever it's getting at the moment. I'm not suggesting that Mittal is an unworthy South African company. It's not. I mean, it's part of our infrastructure. It's part of our fabric. But if we can't sustain a steel business, what are we going to do? Are we going to fake it, you know, and pour government money into it, which we don't already have? We already now, the government is going to pay the salaries of the entire workforce at Newcastle for 1 year, right? Mittal is still saying, well, that may not be enough, actually. You know, what about this and what about that? Help us here, help us there. There's no end to the help they need. And I understand a lot of this new urgency comes after President Cyril Ramaphosa met Lakshmi Mittal, the owner of Mittal, at Davos this year on the side. And there's this new sort of rush to save it, and the tariffs. The tariff investigation, such as it is, Donald, one doesn't know how it ends up, but I mean, presumably the idea is to raise tariffs to protect Mittal and the mini mills and everybody else, right? Who pays for that? Surely that's going to mean more expensive steel for users in South Africa, whether you're a construction company, whether you now, you know, you've now won an infrastructure contract. Finally, you know, Infrastructure South Africa puts out a contract for a railway siding somewhere. You're there, you're near, it's in Kumcha in the Eastern Cape. You win the contract, but, you know, the steel is now so expensive because it's all protected. Your price is high. And the government says, well, hang on a second, you know, we hadn't budgeted that much for you. I mean, where does it all stop? When do you say, you know, we don't need to be a steel producer? Do we really need to be a steel producer in South Africa? Lots of countries are competitive and strong and powerful without making their own steel, you know? And I mean, they're not necessarily big, but I don't know how much steel Norway makes, or Hungary, or even Britain. I mean, the UK is now closing down its last integrated mill at Scunthorpe. You know, it's going to be okay. There's lots of steel around.
Yeah, so I think, again, we have a tendency in our industrial policy to focus on making sure the sun never sets on a sunset industry. And we do this all the time. It's not unique to steel. Having said all of that, there is a crisis. And what I do appreciate with what ITAC has done, I've got many criticisms, but what is good is that they're looking at all of this. And I think where it goes wrong is we're assuming a level of knowledge within government that I'm just not sure is there. This is not a question of competence. It's just there is so much information that everyone in the steel industry is having to take every single day on every procurement decision. It's not obvious to me how that gets replicated in a steel policy, especially one as granular as this one. So one of the proposals being at least considered is take everything up to the bound rate, which is our maximum rate we can take it to under the WTO. It's to take it up to that maximum rate. And then what we'll do is we will grant rebates. In other words, a rebate is an exemption from the duty. The problem with that is you've got to get a permit. There are capacity constraints in ITAC. ITAC are very shorthanded at the moment. So permits take time. ITAC is proposing to add a cost every time you apply for a permit. That's something being considered. So the problem is you're going to add a tariff, you're going to create exemptions. The exemptions are going to be difficult to process at scale. This is an enormous review. So we're talking about 67 billion rands worth of imports a year. You know, it's covering 609 tariff codes. It's big.
Is it necessary?
Well, I think what I would have preferred is a review which is a little bit more staggered. I think it's a good thing that tariffs are reviewed periodically to see if they still make any sense. But I think to do a review this big, which is not only looking at tariffs, but is also looking at iron ore, for example. So they're considering some sort of mechanism to reduce the cost of iron ore and coking coal to Mittal. They're looking at stainless steel, not just mild steel. They're looking at the whole value chain. So this thing goes everywhere from iron ore to padlocks and wheelbarrows. And that's just an enormous scope. And so being able to make that assessment at the best of times is difficult. I mean, remember, a typical tariff investigation, Peter, takes around 27 months to complete. And Minister Tao wants feedback by July of this year. So, you know, what worries me when you've got such complexity and all of it's happening very urgently is we get unintended consequences that are not properly accounted for. Yeah. And the unintended consequences can be existential to some companies. You know, you can't do all of this and expect some companies to not fail. So maybe it's not Mittal, but there's no way everyone comes through this with what is being proposed unscathed. And, you know, in some ways, the job of government is to govern. So, you know, ITAC has to take, I think, some incredibly difficult decisions here. But a lot of this problem is that nobody's wanted to take those decisions for years. So, you know, I think this review is too big. I think it should have been broken up into smaller reviews. But the problem, of course, is that they've procrastinated for years, and now you've got this pressure, yeah. Which is...
When you say they've got to make some big decisions which should have been taken a long time ago, give me an example. I mean, what are they having to do now that they could have done a year ago, 2 years ago?
I think a few years ago, these tariffs should have been reviewed. The overproduction of steel is not a new thing.
Yeah.
You know, Minister Rob Davies, when he was in charge, took a political decision for South Africa to stop using our countervailing instrument, which is the instrument you use to deal with subsidies. So we have the law, but you practically can't use the instrument. The world is currently awash with subsidized product. So there's an instrument that we should be using. And by the way, not just against China, the US is an enormous subsidizer of all sorts of product. You know, what we did was we took political decisions when we joined BRICS that make no sense whatsoever. You know, so we took a decision because we were joining BRICS. I'm not entirely sure what we thought we would get in return for it. But what has happened is we've now created this pressure where the rest of the world has been dealing with the subsidies. We've instead been sitting with an inability to. So I think these reviews... Yeah. Should have happened years ago.
Yeah.
Companies should have had access to the correct instruments, and they just haven't.
Well, yeah, I also remember you talk about Rob Davies. I mean, at one stage, the state was refusing to buy steel from Mittal because it wanted the steel at developmental prices. Have you ever heard such nonsense? So, I mean, I remember in the industrial action policy plans or whatever the hell they were called that Davies used to bring out. At once, I clearly remember reading there that there was an instruction for the state or Eskom not to buy Mittal steel for its power line transmission towers because its pricing was too high. So they forced the pricing down, and voila, you know, 10 years later, the Eskom can't make a profit, and it's going to close the plant anyway. So, Donald, I think you've been co-opted onto the advisory council, have you not, of Minister Parks Tower at the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. Cyril Ramaphosa also has an advisory council, Economic Advisory Council, which he routinely ignores. What expectations do you have as an advisor to Minister Tao?
You know, again, I'm trying to give everyone the benefit of the doubt here. You know, I think Minister Tao is in a little bit of a bind here because politically he has to confront some bad policy decisions that he's inherited. I think he very much understands that those have to change, but that's a fairly long process. You know, policies are not just about a politician, but they're also about the bureaucracy below that person.
For so, sure. You know, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I think it's easier on paper. Yeah. I also think, you know, politically, these things are not that easy to sell because for much of what has to be fixed, you're trying to argue back to your political principles, that what they've very publicly endorsed for years has been a problem. You know, so you know, a very good example, I suppose, of this is we had when Minister Patel was there. You know, he would state repeatedly our kind of main objective with industrial policies: we've got to reduce our non-oil imports by, I think it was 20 or 25% a year, which is essentially an import replacement strategy. The new strategy, which I think is a good idea, is a shift away from that to competitiveness. But the problem is you've got to figure out what to do with this word localization, which you can't simply drop. And so there's I think he's got a tough job on his hand to figure out how do you message all of this. I wish him well. There's certainly not for lack of effort, and we're on a panel of very competent people. But I think it is, you know, knowing what the correct answer is, but being able to politically implement it is difficult.
Yeah. If you had the opportunity to recast industrial policy, now what would your top three items be? You've got the minister for 6 months. What are you gonna fix? Or start fixing. Nothing gets fixed quickly, obviously. What are your top three things?
So if we're saying that South Africa has to become more competitive, which I think is something everyone agrees on by now, then your problem is that you can't fix that with industrial policy, because it's not industrial policy that has created the problem. So, you know, I would argue that You've got a great role for anyone in that job. And again, Minister Tao is trying very hard to do this, is to figure out what are the other barriers you've got to fix. But the challenge here is that for many of those, they are going to take years. So, you know, Transnet has behaved very poorly with regards to our rail import infrastructure for years, and they've been protected for years. And lots of money was stolen out of Transnet, which is probably never going to come back. So now the problem is you've got a rail import operator whose balance sheet just looks all wrong. They don't have money to do the things that they should be doing. And so that's a big problem. That's a far bigger problem than your industrial policy can fix.
Yeah,
we've got to figure out that the unemployed in our country, when our unemployment rate is a national disgrace for everyone, no person should have to kind of start their working life at a traffic light somewhere because they're unemployable in many cases. But that's a hard problem to solve. We've had labor policies which have made it unattractive to employ people. And on the other hand, we've had an education system which does not match the economy we have. So, you know, kind of explain what I mean by that. The people that are unemployed are not the engineers and graduates. Maybe there's some in there. But for the most part, the people that are unemployed haven't finished high school. And much of our industrial policy focuses on the capital-intensive part of our industry, like ArcelorMittal or the mini mills, not the labor-intensive part, like services, as an example. So the ability to absorb the unemployed that we have is not always matched by the policies that we have. So the policies are not creating an environment where employing those people is easier. In fact, we've made it quite difficult to employ those people. And so factories very often just find it easier to import. So I think, you know, we've got to deal with those fundamentals. And the problem with that is that none of those give you a short-term gain, Peter. There are some quick wins. You know, I think we've recommended to the minister, get rid of all the tariffs on products that are not made locally. Just have that as a principle. Don't overthink it. Just get rid of it. And, you know, agree to wrap up your investigations quickly. We launch our sixth import duty investigation report tomorrow, actually. And, you know, in that report, we are seeing some improvement, but we're also not seeing enough of it for it to make a measurable difference. And I think, you know, what we want is government to become trustworthy again. I know when I ask for an increase, what the rules are. I'm not squeezed to sign a reciprocal agreement in order to get duties removed on a product I can't import, just make that process more predictable. And I think on the competition side, we have to make mergers less expensive and more predictable. We cannot be taking as long for mergers as we do. I think those things are fairly quick wins because yes. We're not introducing anything new. And I think the minister has some kind of obligation to better explain his thinking with the transformation fund, for example, which at the moment, I think all of us are confused. So I would give clarity on those things, make it a little bit easier for people to get behind the policies and just get rid of the bad ones. I mean, we know what the bad policies are. I'm at least skeptical that sucking 100 billion out of the productive economy over 5 years is a good idea.
I mean, I understand Park Tower's position, right? The DTIC was originally going to go to the DA in the new government of national unity, and then the ANC, Park Tower might have been one of them who did it, clawed it back into as an ANC ministry because it runs BEE and all that sort of thing. But at some stage, this is being South Africa, you have to talk about redress, still necessary. I don't think you can not have redress in this country, not by a long shot. Is there a way to do it that's also economically growth friendly? In other words, can you have redress and growth? Because at the moment, we haven't got it. We've got redress, and they call it inclusive growth, but it's not, because there's no growth. So it's just redress. Is there growth in redress, or can you suck growth out of redress? Can it be done better? Is there some entrepreneurial way of making a poor man's life better and making some money at the same time you do that?
Well, Peter, just I completely concur with you that I don't think we can ignore redress. I'm certainly not somebody who thinks we should just pretend that you can have a free market and all kind of ships will be raised by the rising tide. I think we're making it very hard for poor people to not be poor. So firstly, we've got to say growth is really important. If you don't have growth, it doesn't matter what other policies you have, you're going nowhere. So, whatever redress policies you have are just going to make the economy move more slowly, not because redress is a bad idea, but because there's nothing to take it out of. The pie is not getting any bigger, and slicing everyone else's slices thinner will just cause companies to not invest here. So I think that's something that has to be addressed first. But I'd also say we don't make it easy for small businesses to thrive. We're a highly regulated economy, very often regulating things that don't make sense. We've got a vibrant township economy, but now we're not happy because we have foreigners who are running spaza shops. And so we're kind of saying, well, that should be South African. Why are these foreigners running the shops? Except they are running the shops and the South Africans are not, and they're providing a valuable service. So, we have a take on South Africa, which I think is incredibly similar to Donald Trump's take, which is a very kind of siege mentality. It's if something's not working, what we should do is protect it from competition rather than say, how do we make South African entrepreneurs in townships more competitive rather than let's take out the Somalian or Kiribatis? I just don't think that gets us anywhere. And you don't become good at something by not being exposed to competition. We see that in our sports. We're very good at certain sports, but we only know that because we're faced with the world's best competition. If you're removing and reducing that competition, that edge is lost. And I fear that we create an environment where all of the protectionism means that the most innovative companies never have an opportunity to find their space in the sun.
Isn't it interesting? I just, as you're talking, remember that every time Ibrahim Patel was faced with a problem, part of the solution was always to drop the competition rules as a as they apply to that sector, or, you know, he did it. Yeah. So, you know, what he wanted to stop was companies talking to each other about what they were doing and cooperating and, you know, colluding was what, you know, on prices. It was obviously what he was trying to do. But in breaking the collusion on price apart, he broke a lot of other things as well, I suspect. And there's no real cooperation between companies in South Africa anymore. And perhaps the kind of thing you would want to see, you know, in poorer communities is people learning how to collaborate to produce money for themselves, to make money. Just like people now running, you know, trading stores around the place. They've got networks way back into South Asia. And you know, there's a culture behind all of those little shops and their success that we've deliberately stomped on in South Africa in a way. And every time, you know, things got a bit rough, as I said, for Patel, he dropped the competition aspect. Why? You know, because it worked. But Donald, listen, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining. And I hope we see you again soon. That was lovely, absolutely lovely. And thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with another podcast from The Edge. And meanwhile, keep well and stay safe. Bye-bye.